listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza.
Alan Cardoza.
Only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome, I'm Alan Cardoza, and you're here with Answers for the Family. Today, I want to first tell you about my co-host. My co-host is Sherry Gaba. Sherry's a licensed psychotherapist and life coach who has helped hundreds of people cope with lifelong addictions, eating disorders, depression, anxiety, and much more. Sherry, did you think when you were a guest on the show last year, and I asked you to come back, that you'd be doing it as a co-host?
You know, it didn't cross my mind, but I'm very excited and honored that you've asked me to be here today.
Well, we're very happy to have you here, and we have our guest today. Our guest today is Brenda Nixon. Brenda is an author and a parent educator, and Brenda earned her master's degree in religious education. She worked as a hospital chaplain, parent educator, and then served as the parenting expert on Fox TV in Kansas City. Let's bring her up. Brenda, welcome to the show. Brenda, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
There we go. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So you're in Ohio. How are things in Ohio right now?
Actually, it's lovely. It's slightly overcast, about 70 degrees, dry humidity. It's really a nice summer day.
Well, glad to hear that. I had a chance to read a little bit about your book. Tell us a little bit about your new book as far as dealing with the children at a very young age.
Well, I tell you, Alan, I just think that the whole parenting career is foundation. You know, the foundation, it's balanced on those first 5 years. And, of course, we know developmentally those are the years of rapid development, growth, change. But it's also the foundational years of the parent-child relationship and the authority, and it's just so critical. And, of course, there's just, you know, myriad issues that parents face everywhere from knowing if their child's development is normal to finding quality child care or knowing if they're going to be ready for kindergarten. So the book came out of actually a request of many, many parents whom I'd spoken with in my audiences, because I'm also a speaker. And, you know, they just had repetitive questions about discipline, toilet teaching, kindergarten readiness. So put it all together in a book, and hopefully it gives a solid foundation to parents who want to start out with a strong parenting career and relationship with their child.
Well, Brenda, is there anything that you see that we're doing as parents today that has changed the outcome, that has given us the teenagers that we are looking at now?
Well, maybe to define what you mean now by the teenagers we're looking at today.
Well, I mean, I'm not saying that either from a positive or a negative standpoint. I'm just saying that there's a lot of diversity going on now in regards to what we're seeing in teenagers. We're seeing some incredibly wonderful, brilliant teenagers that mm-hmm. are taking an interest in politics. They're taking an interest in globally what's going on. You know, I think that's very positive. On the other hand, I know that we're struggling with drug addiction. We're struggling with violence. You know, we're struggling in a lot of areas as well. What can we be doing with them in the 0 to 5 years that maybe will give us more of those that I mentioned first and less that I mentioned last?
Good question, Alan. I think that the most important things parents can do is embrace those first 5 years and take it as a serious profession or career. And with any career, you go to continuing education, you read, you talk to others in the industry, you want to learn, you want to improve, you want to get better. Likewise with parenting, just because, you know, we can biologically give birth to a child doesn't mean that we have all the skills and the confidence to relate to a child or to handle challenging behaviors or to know what the child most needs. So we need to, of course, trust our gut, because a lot of it is instinctual, but we also need to read, continue to improve, learn as much as we can. And I think those first 5 years are the most critical. And one of the ways that we can have those teenagers today that you had first mentioned, the strong, powerful teenagers who are invested in society is to develop a strong sense of self-worth or self-esteem in that child, self-respect. And that can be done day one when you have an infant. You begin developing self-esteem and teaching self-worth.
Brenda, I have a question for you. One of the things that I do is I work a lot with single parents and I work a lot with addictions. You know, there's this idea of the mommy wars, the moms that stay home and the moms that go to work. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, that's a good question, too. I try to be very neutral or middle of the road throughout this book because I do cover a lot of hot topics like whether you should spank or not and all this. Breastfeeding is another hot topic, and, you know, people can get polarized on it. But the mommy wars of, you know, going to work, staying at home, I tell you what, each side has bitter and sweet, and I've been both. I've been the mom who works, and I've been the mom who stayed home, and I don't feel like anyone is better than the other if the parent is committed to being a parent. Now, those who stay at home but then, you know, run around, put their child every single day in a Mother's Day Out program and, you know, basically aren't spending any quality time with their children, why are they better than the parent who has to work 40 and 50 hours a week and doesn't see their child?
Or
it's an attitude of, you know, how seriously are you going to embrace parenting, whether you work outside or not for employment?
Well, also, it's about the mother who resents being home. You know, if
she's exactly not. And I've known moms that have stayed home because they felt that voice in their head was telling them to do that, and then they weren't happy and they were passing that misery on to their child.
Okay. Well, and that's a great point. And you mentioned about instilling self-esteem from day one. Okay, what are some of the ways that you can accomplish that? I think many of us, you know, would like to do that but don't really know how we would do that with a relative newborn.
Okay, some of the very basic practical ways is obviously eye contact. Look at your child. The eye is the pathway to the soul. Teach a baby the names of body parts. Repeat the child's name with a very positive voice or tone in your voice quality. So the name associated with the child is a pleasant sound. Hold your baby up and let them see the reflection in the mirror and talk about that. And the interesting thing is babies don't realize that is themselves. They think that's just another baby that they're seeing. They don't understand reflection yet. But it's the idea of interacting with your child and beginning to teach your child that he or she is a separate body and has proper names for the body parts. Respond quickly and consistently to a young baby under the age of 6 months when they cry, because this is sending a message that your needs are valid. You know, somebody will listen to your needs and verify them. And research has shown that if parents respond quickly and consistently in the first 5 to 6 months, that children actually cry less when they're older because they have learned that their needs are valued and are recognized and their needs will be taken care of, and it helps with the bonding process. And see, those are just ways of building self-esteem, which is a self-respect or quiet sense of inner worth.
So what you're talking about is learning how to self-soothe. They're learning how to take care of their needs later on in life if they get that early developmental nurturing, correct?
Absolutely. And our brain only has the first 12 months. The first year of life is when the neural pathways for emotional connectedness develop. And so in those first 12 months, if a baby is given soothing interaction and is learning to self-soothe, those first 12 months are when, you know, the emotional connections are made, and that's when the baby is learning, self-calming skills that will take them into adolescent and adulthood.
Now, Brenda, how early should we be socializing them? And I say that because one of my sons, I mean, everybody says he's incredibly well socialized. He gets along with everybody, and he gets along with adults as well as kids. And he is the one that, when I was a young investigator, and I would put reports on my lap or on his lap, and I'd put him on a rolling chair when I had to deliver the reports to different companies. So I would go into an insurance company, set him in a chair, put the reports in his lap, and roll along. and have him hand them out, if he could, you know, hand them out to the different people. And I'm wondering, do you think that that helped with the fact that he can interact so well with people of so many ages?
Okay, two issues here. One is that for the first 3 years of life, a child's only interest and only social interaction really is the parent or the primary caregiver. So for parents who feel they have to socialize their child and, you know, he's 2 years old and he, you know, doesn't know how to make friends, not to worry, because really their best friend is mom or dad. And so parents don't need to feel guilty those first 3 years if they happen to stay home and don't get their child out in group environments. It's okay. Around the age of three, 2.5 to 3, mm-hmm. children start developing an interest in otherness and, you know, and in making friends, so their interest goes beyond the nuclear family. Now, the second thing, Alan, is that it could be your son seems so well socialized because, yes, you got him out and exposed him to a variety of people, but it also could be part of his temperament, which is an inborn trait. It's how the brain is hardwired to respond. And it could be your wonderful son is just hardwired to be outgoing and gregarious anyhow.
Is it true that babies, early toddlers, get their socialization skills from their dads? Because I know I've
mom
done
and dad both.
Really? Because there used to be literature that said it comes from dad. And I always kind of question that. Well, what about the, you know, children that didn't have dads? Where did they get their socialization
yeah.
skills from? I mean, did you know, like old literature used
to... Again, the first 3 years, they're only interested in pleasing and interacting and socializing with who that primary caregiver is, whether it's dad or an uncle or a grandma or a mother. And after the age of three, then they start becoming other interested. But, you know, if possible, you know, in an ideal world, it'd be best to have mom and dad both involved in the child care because they each bring a different skill and a different response. And research has shown that even though mom might parent a little differently than dad or maybe dad diapers differently than mom, it's okay because children soon learn to appreciate that as kind of a well-rounded reception on their needs.
Now, what would you say to the parent that is maybe doubting that they're doing a good job? I know that a lot of new parents, you know, really are just insecure about their own abilities.
Right. Been there, done that. I had a master's degree in education when my first daughter rolled along, and I still felt dumb as a doorknob. I tell you, having a child brings out emotions in you you never thought you had. And I too, you know, second-guessed myself and was afraid I was doing something wrong that was going to permanently scar her. But as I point out in the Birth to Five book, it's the overall haul, you know, the long nights when they're sick or those two quick Christmas mornings and all the many, many things you do together, the first step for first bicycle ride, first day off to camp. These are what create bonds. These are what create happiness. And if you make a mistake once or twice or you lose your temper, you're probably a normal parent. And that's not going to permanently scar your child if it's not a habitual behavior.
You know, Al and I work with troubled kids to a certain
right.
extent. And so, of course, we're hoping to have kids that evolve to have wonderful self-esteem like you were talking about earlier. But we are learning that trauma really does start early on and that there can be, you know, real bodily responses to a parent leaving or to fighting in the home. What are your thoughts about that? Because there really is literature that shows that early trauma really will affect later addictions, inability to self-soothe, you know, and the other issues that go on for troubled teens.
Oh, you're so right. I mean, it's sad, but it's truth. It's reality. Children who are exposed to chronic stress, which is habitually in an environment that's negative, where there's name-calling or physical abuse or emotional abuse or neglect, or a child maybe who is exposed to sudden crises, like maybe, you know, a drunken parent comes into the home and stops, you know, starts hitting on the parent or hitting on the child. These create what's called a surgence of cortisol, which is hormone. Cortisol actually wash over the developing brain like an acid and will kill brain cells. And there's been CAT scans and MRIs to show that when a child is exposed to chronic or a very impactful, sudden crisis, that the brain is actually smaller than a child who's come up in a relatively stable, predictable, happy home life.
Would you put a nasty divorce as being something that falls in that category?
Oh, yeah. Anytime it's... See, sometimes parents think, well, the child's so young, he won't pick up on it. Children are like little Martians with antennae, and they pick up on every nuance in the home. They feel stress. They feel trauma, even if the parent hasn't verbalized it to them directly. If mom or dad is incredibly unhappy, that stress is going to be perceived by the child. The child is going to pick up on that. And, of course, most children are unskilled in knowing how to express themselves, or they lack the words, and so they act it out through behavior. Well, then, you know, in the example of a nasty, ugly divorce, you have a child who's acting out stress and perceived agitation, and then the parents say, I don't know why he's acting like that. He's just, you know, being such a brat. And the parent sees it as a discipline problem when really it needs to be a de-stressing problem.
Okay, now what can be done if it's already happened? Now, you know, you have a situation. Is it something, you know, when you were saying this about it's like an acid washing over the brain, that was pretty scary.
Cortisol.
Yeah. Now, what about those situations where it's already happened? Now you have the situation, the parents are going, what can we do to improve that situation?
Tough question, because, you know, the fact is the child has already sustained some trauma. The best thing parents can do, whether they're, you know, single parents or going through a nasty, ugly divorce, or they're an intact married family, the best thing parents can do for children is to give them routine. Children like it when their life is comfortably predictable. They feel safer. They're better behaved because there's less stress in their life. So parents do children a favor when they have the same old every day. Same bedtime, same bath time, same routine and rituals of getting ready in the morning for school, or getting ready to, you know, go out the door to a daycare provider. Same old, even on the weekends. And there is a myth that if children are up late on Friday night, they'll sleep in Saturday and make up for it. But neurologically, our bodies are not made that way. Neurologically, Alan, when we lose sleep, our body doesn't make that up. Lost sleep is lost forever. So it is important for parents to sacrifice some of their conveniences or their social life if they have a young child in the home, to give that child a very stable, predictable 24/7 life.
Well, Sherry, as a psychotherapist, you know, can you add to that? What would you say in regards to that?
Well, I think what we're talking about is providing as much stability as possible, not fighting in front of the kids, of course. That can be detrimental. If you're the non-custodial parent, the visits when they're really young, when they're babies, should often be very frequent, and they can be in the custodial home. In other words, coming and visiting the baby in their environment that they're familiar with. That's one thing that can be very beneficial. You know, like what you're talking about, I think, is rituals, giving lots of reassurance and a lot of attention to the kids, not necessarily spoiling them or smothering them, but just giving them, you know, what they need in those early years.
Yeah, that's excellent. Good suggestions. And I also add that parents need to verbally reassure the child, you had nothing to do with this. This is an adult issue. This is between daddy and mommy, because children often assume power over situations they really didn't have power over, but they think maybe they had something to do with the divorce or daddy leaving or mommy leaving.
Absolutely. They don't want to believe that it's their fault. And sometimes they do have, you know, they have a very vivid imagination, and they often do believe that it is their fault. So that reassurance is so right on.
Okay. Well, Brenda, let's talk about the ones that that are having a difficult time. How do the parents, you know, if you have a small child that's acting out, what would you say to the parents that are saying, I just can't get them to mind?
Okay, I hear that a lot.
I'll bet.
I always encourage parents you know, back to the ritual routine, keeping life routine and comfortably predictable as a way to see a decrease in stress and then an improvement in behavior. But also, it's so important for parents to follow through. Now, you can call that consequences or whatever, but when a child or when a parent makes a statement of, you know, this is going to happen, then it needs to happen, or this is not going to happen, then don't let it happen. So parents need to be very consistent and use follow-through. And I often tell parents, you can be firm and kind at the same time. Kindness has to do with your voice and your facial expression. Firmness has to do with your ability to follow through and implement a consequence or a punishment or you know, a lifestyle that you want for your child. So parents can be both firm and calm, and that makes for a happier child. And really, children are happier when adults are running the household. So it is dangerous to let a child, you know, make all the decisions and get away with everything and be spoiled, because they're not a happy child.
You know, Brenda, earlier you talked about how children will act out sometimes when they're in a traumatic sort of home life. How does a parent differentiate between actual acting out because of the situation or actual, you know, behavioral issues? How do you determine, you know, which is really just normal behavior due to the trauma that's going on and the changes and the instability versus just acting out behavior that need to be that needs to be disciplined?
Sometimes it's hard. It takes a lot of observation, really carefully watching your student. Parents can be a student of their child, and they can watch their child and learn. Usually, if it is a behavior that has been induced through trauma, it'll be maybe a regression, like a child who used to suck their thumb and quit, but now they're back to it, or a child who is starting to wet the bed again. So you'll begin seeing a regressive behavior, or you'll see an intensity, like a child who maybe has a temper tantrum once a day will start having longer and more passionate temper tantrums.
Okay.
Brenda, I was just looking at something in regards to schooling. And I noticed that in your book you had mentioned something about how parents can nurture their child's love for school. Now, I may be starting this a little bit too late, but I could sure use some help on that one. I've got one of my sons that he just isn't really excited about school. It doesn't mean he can't do it, but it's just not one of his favorite things. So what are some of the things that we can do, even if it's now, if they're now, 10, 11, 12 years old?
Yeah, okay, so what grade's he in?
He will be going into seventh grade.
Okay, and he's never had a history, a track record of embracing school and loving it?
Not at all. From day one, he can do the work. It just isn't really all that exciting for him.
Okay, a couple things come to mind. Just remember that as he's entering, you say he's going into sixth grade?
Seventh.
Seventh grade, okay, middle school.
Right.
That can be pretty trauma-inducing on kids because things get really rough come middle school.
Mm-hmm.
I tease my colleagues who are teachers in the middle school, you know, that they wear their combat boots. But, you know, kids feel that sense of change and older kids and new expectations. But if your child's never had a real track record for loving school and education, it could be he's a different kind of learner that the schools need to address because, you know, there's different types of learners. B, he could, in fact, be gifted, and so he gets bored with the mundane, regular ways of teaching and learning. I mean, he already knows the answer. He doesn't want to learn how to get to the answer. He knows the answer.
Yeah. No, and you're right, and I've had that discussion with him, you know, that that sometimes just because it's not exciting to you or whatever, you know, get it done, move on. I know that you can do this stuff. When we're sitting down at home and we're going over it, he may get it if he wants to do something else immediately after that. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are you talking about bribery, Alan?
You know,
no, I try to stay away from
parents,
that.
Parents who want to really nurture a love for children and for school and their children need to, of course, model it, show an eagerness to learn, take a continuing education class at a community school just to show that, hey, we're never too old to learn or try something new. Let your children see you reading books and magazines and see your quest for knowledge. Speak positively of the teachers. There's going to be a year or maybe two or three. You don't really like the school teacher, mm-hmm. but you still need to speak positive and approach it as a team attitude. The teacher's there to teach and do his or her best, and you need to listen to the teacher and be respectful and cooperate. And, you know, I don't want to go to a parent-teacher conference and hear that, you know, you've been the class clown. You know, so encourage the child to really listen to the teacher and respect that authority, because that's going to make the classroom environment more pleasant. And then always let your child be invested in, like, the school clothes and supplies and equipment that he needs, because if he's invested in the decision, he's more invested in the outcome. So if he's taken to the store and allowed to pick out some of his clothes and his school supplies, and he is making those choices, he's going to be more excited about using those school supplies and wearing those school clothes to go to school and things like that.
Well, I think you make a great point about supporting the teachers, because I know that we've seen a certain shift in society to where, you know, many of the parents are not, you know, they're not supporting the teachers. In fact, they're doing just the opposite. They're going ahead and blaming. You know, they'll go into the principal and say, well, it must be the teacher's fault. You know, they want to place fault somewhere else. And
right.
I've seen quite a bit of that.
And not so much the discipline aspect or wanting to love school, but just getting back to the whole divorce and subject. When a child's going through change, it's really important to educate the teacher about what's going on with that child.
Great
so
point.
That if any acting out is happening at school, you know, they might have special counseling knowing that this child's going through some changes.
Yeah, great point.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And other changes, like the death of a relative, a
right.
death of a sibling, a death of a pet, these things traumatize kids, and they could act out just because of that short-term stress.
I don't know if you have this in Ohio, but out here there's something called Our House, where they go to the schools and they have grief groups for kids.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I don't know if you have that there, but it's actually in the school district.
Huh. If they have it here, it must be under another name, because I haven't heard of that.
Yeah.
Me neither. Well, tell us something surprising, or something that may be considered ordinary but is actually surprising, that traits them that young parents can expect from their toddlers?
Well, a lot of times parents talk about the terrible twos, and personally I hate to hear that, because it sounds like they're being prophetic, or they're, you know, expecting that it's going to be a traumatic, awful, ugly time, and I'm going to have to really, you know, be, you know, on my guard. But developmentally, the quote terrible twos is really between the first and the second birthday, because they're in their second year of life. So the issues of power, control, and independence really happen after 12 months, not when they had their second birthday. But I would like to see parents be more positive and embrace that each phase of your child's growth and development can be fun, can be exciting, can be new and fresh. And when my girls were growing up, I personally refused to refer to it as the terrible twos, because I thought, well, now I'm already telling myself it's going to be a negative situation, and that's going to compromise my skills. I just chose to believe this is going to be a fun, exciting time. Yeah, it's got its challenges, but what stage of parenting doesn't? And so for parents with toddlers, you know that they're very selfish. They haven't had enough life experience to learn how to share yet. Besides, the word share is a concept, and they think in concrete terms. Everything revolves around them and their needs. That's developmentally normal, although it's not pleasant. But just expect that and know that it will get better as they get older. And, of course, parents need to remember what powerful role models they are. They are the first and most influential teacher from day one clear through, you know, the teen years when they're in high school. And parents need to model patience and asking for help and the things that they want to see out of their toddler, too.
You know, Brenda, I've done some work with mindfulness, and I have learned a lot that, you know, being a mindful parent can be really helpful, just sort of being present, you know, even in their destruction. You know, just, you know, not so much being that authoritative parent always punishing or, you know, being good or being bad, but just sort of being there. You know, a lot of parents get very frustrated, and this is just all about being there in the moment so that they feel heard for who they are and what they are.
Absolutely. And again, that goes back to building self-esteem. I mean, the child feels listened to. They feel valued. And we don't always have to approve of their behavior, but we can understand it may be a time-limited developmental phase, and that can moderate some of our response.
Mm-hmm. Now, Brenda, do you see any differences brought on by having more fathers these days being involved with their children? So I know the difference just from going back one generation, you know, my father's generation versus, you know, to me and being the room dad and things like that. How do you think that's affecting the kids that are coming up now?
Well, I tell you, when dads can be involved in daily child care, the research supports that the children have higher IQ and the children feel so much more secure that they actually cry less when they're left in the presence of a stranger or in a new situation, you know, like going for the first time to a classroom with a new teacher or getting on the bus with a new bus driver. So if dads can be involved in daily child care, I mean, that is the ideal way to help a child feel very safe and valued and to boost their school success. And I often can tell when dads have taken time to sit down and read storybooks to the children because their children seem to have that attention span massaged and nurtured, and they're able to sit down and attend to a book or sit down and entertain themselves with a puzzle. So dads being involved is so critically important. But, you know, a lot of times dads want to be involved, but mothers can have such power. Dr. T. Barry Brazelton, you know, the pediatrician, yeah. I just love him, he coined the phrase gatekeepers. And he said sometimes moms act as gatekeepers. They decide when and how much dads are involved.
Hmm. Well, I mean, taking that one step further, and let me ask this question of both you and Sherry, is how do you think it relates based on the way in which one parent treats the other as to how that child grows up to treat people of the same or opposite sex? So in other words, based on the way in which they see mom treating dad or dad treating mom, how do you think that translates as they get older?
Well, yeah, unfortunately, when there is, let's say, physical abuse or verbal abuse, it can be modeled, and unfortunately, the studies do show that it can be repeated later on in life. I mean, it really is a shame in those cases. So I think, obviously, modeling respect and for the other parent is really the best way to go in order to instill respect in the kids and how they treat future partners and relationships.
Mm-hmm. And Brenda?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, parents are the first and most influential teachers, so the way that they act towards the child's other parent is how the child is going to grow up believing that's how you should treat that parent or that other gender or whatever. Yeah, that other adult in their life.
What about parentifying children? I mean, I hate to keep going back to divorce, but often that's the case where I was a single mother and sometimes I spoke to my daughter about things that were very adult that really, you know, probably was more for a partner versus a child. And so my daughter did grow up a little bit faster. So we don't want to do that. We want to teach, you know, we want to teach parents, whether they're single parents or not, not to treat their children as little kids. I mean, as adults.
Right.
We want to treat them as little kids, as children, because
right.
the burden
right.
is just so great to treat them as adults, because then they really take on adult issues, which are just way too early for them.
So
I guess your thought is how to really help parents understand not to parentify their children.
And what would you say to that, Brenda?
Oh, that's a tough one. I know in some situations there is what I like to call an emotional incest. The parent actually assumes that the child can take on that emotional role of being the partner, and they're not. Let children be children. Don't rob children out of the innocence and the naivete of childhood. For parents who are really struggling with that and they need to talk about it and they need catharsis, good. But go find another adult. Go find somebody within your own generation or somebody older and wiser to talk to. But it's really important for parents to try to keep adult issues away from the child, because the child has no power to change it anyhow.
That's so
true. What's the use of it?
Okay. Brenda, let me ask you a couple more questions of things that I got from reading your book. Now, I didn't get a chance to read all of it, but I went through it enough that that I saw that there were some great points that you brought up, and one of which had to do with children being grateful. And I know that, I mean, we live in the land of abundance. You know, how do you suggest parents teach their children to be grateful for all the things that we have?
Yeah, that's a tough one, and I've had a lot of people ask me about that, especially now with the state of our economy, and kids are having less and less material possessions. Parents, are, again, being the first and most influential teacher, have to first of all have the attitude that, you know, enough's enough, we're doing okay, we are blessed beyond our means, but just some very practical ways, that any parent can do regardless of their socioeconomic standing. Look at other people who maybe have less than you, and instead of comparing up to people who have more, you know, compare down to people who are struggling and who have less and maybe need a helping hand. And in fact, give a helping hand. We all have abundance. We all have a little we can share with somebody else. So teaching children to give, not just to hoard and keep and get for themselves, but to give away. Take your children with you. If you've cleaned out your closet or your garage and you're taking things to a donation center or a woman's shelter, take your children with you. Let
Absolutely.
Them see you giving away to help other people. Or go to a homeless shelter and serve a meal once a month or during the holidays. These are ways to help children see that there's a whole variety of people in this world, and whatever you have, there's always somebody who has more, and there's always going to be somebody who has less.
That's such a great point, Brenda.
Important.
That's such a great point. I mean, I think it also provides for rituals for kids. I mean, I'm thinking of like around holiday time, if kids know that this is going to be their yearly activity to go, you know, feed the homeless, it's something to look forward to, and it provides structure and stability and consistency, and it's just a wonderful way for kids to enjoy the holidays without it being all about material gifts.
Right.
And exactly. And funny story, several years ago when my daughters were much younger, we went to a homeless shelter in Kansas City where we were living at the time, and we were serving a Thanksgiving meal. And, of course, my daughter, who was a young adolescent at the time, you know, just thought Mom was always so mean and so strict and such a, you know, mean mom. Well, she met at this shelter while she was helping us pass out a meal. She met this 14-year-old who was a throwaway. None of the states wanted him. His family didn't want him. You know, he was just kind of one of those that fell between the cracks. And my daughter got to talking to him, and on the drive home from that homeless shelter that evening, I mean, she had a whole new definition of what a mean mom is.
Yeah. Talk about being grateful.
Oh.
Yeah,
yes,
really.
Exactly.
She goes home to her nice house where she has a bedroom to herself and doesn't have to share it, you know, in a bunk situation with 14 other men.
Right.
Well, and to add to the point about it being a ritual, I think that's great. And I know that with my boys, they've been able to do things like that. We've set things up, but then their friends want to get involved. So in other words, they started telling their friends, hey, we're going to be going down to an orphanage in Mexico, and we're taking a bunch of things down. And now you have their friends bringing over bags of clothes or toys that they're not using, and getting that same feeling. So now their friends look up to them and recognize the fact that this power of giving can give them a good feeling. So yeah, I think it's something that'll spread. If you indoctrinate your own children into it, they will then share it with others, and that's how things grow.
Yeah, and it's the best therapy I can think of for depression, is to stop thinking about yourself and start giving out and thinking of others. Because if you start to feel yourself sliding down that slippery slope and, you know, poor me and look what I don't have, but you start looking outward and giving to other people, it's a real fast cure for that.
Okay. I noticed you also mentioned in your book some age-appropriate gifts for children. What are some of your favorites from the list, and what do you recommend?
Well, I like the things that don't have a lot of bells, whistles, and batteries.
Thank you.
Because I like to encourage children to use their imagination. So, you know, books are always appropriate. And you can start with the thick, sturdy cardboard books with toddlers, or, you know, those soft vinyl ones that are easy to wash off for little babies. But books, just all through their whole life, can be a wonderful way to take their mind to other lands and nurture that imagination. Balls are good, different sizes and shapes of balls, musical instruments, and of course, having children listen to music is good. That's a good brain stimulus. But having them actually engage in or invent music, the research tells us, is a better stimulation on the brain. For older children, you know, board games, card games, video games, give them a simple camera and help them start taking pictures. People don't even think that, you know, if you give them a child-sized sleeping bag, this could be something that could open up a whole new thought process of camping or being outdoors or, you know, appreciating nature. So, again, you know, I don't necessarily promote a certain manufacturer brand product, but I just like the ones that, you know, really nurture a child's imagination and pretending skills and that have multiple play values. So that's the best value you can get when you buy a gift for a child, is how many play values, how many senses does it stimulate, how long will it last? Is it something they play with 1 week and they're done with it, or is it something that will last them for a year or two?
Well, and I think you nailed it when you mentioned that, because I was thinking as you were saying that about all the things you were mentioning are things that stimulate our imagination, which then poses the question, in this day and age to where everything is being done for them, in other words, television doesn't necessarily leave as much for the imagination or the computer or anything else, are we losing something as we lose part of our imagination?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, what is it that we're losing, and how would you see that in the future? You know, what are we not going to have in the future because of that?
Well, and this also, I just want to bring up, when schools do away with recess and free play, mm-hmm. I just think that's to the detriment of our children. But children who are nurtured and allowed to pretend and play and given open-ended activities, and by that I mean there's no right way to do it, like sidewalk chalk, that's an open-ended activity. They just go out and create and play and draw all over the sidewalk or the driveway. Those children seem to be happier, more secure, they do better in school, and they have better problem-solving abilities. So there's a lot of power in just free and unstructured play.
You know, I wanted to mention, Brenda, about books. Books are a great tool for children to understand if they do come from a divorce. It's a great way for them to identify with a character. There's a great book, Dinosaur Divorce. You probably know about that book, Alan.
Okay,
and it's just, you know about that one too, Brenda. It's just a fantastic way to kind of transform and come up with a visual for something that's very hard to explain to a child verbally. And so I just wanted to mention that books are fantastic for that.
Oh, absolutely. Can I just read a small little quote?
Oh, please do.
It's on page 125 in the Birth to Five book, and it's actually quoting a couple of psychologists at Yale University, Dorothy and Jerome Singer, and they've just devoted their lives to the subject of letting children play and develop their imagination and pretend skills. And they summarize their observations of children in free play this way, quote, "We have found that those who engage in make-believe, what Piaget calls symbolic play, are more joyful and smile and laugh more often than those who seem to be at odds with themselves. The children who wander aimlessly around the nursery, school, or daycare center looking for something to do, who play in a preservative way with few blocks, or who annoy their peers by teasing them or interrupting their games." End quote. So the value of nurturing that imagination and not, you know, always having something entertain the child, but the child learn to entertain himself.
Well, one of the problems today are the texting and, you know, all of these, the computers, and you mentioned the video games. I mean, I feel like kids are just not even knowing how to socialize.
They aren't learning how to negotiate and compromise, or they're not learning problem-solving skills.
How about eye contact?
Yeah.
There's no eye contact with texting and computers
that.
Well, exactly. In fact, and I've pointed out with the texting part is that it allows people to get their point across without having to take in any feedback from somebody else. So, you know, if you tell somebody to call you so that you can discuss something, then there's going to be an interaction between two people, a dialogue back and forth. And if somebody's going to comment on it in a manner that you may not like, you don't have to hear that in a text. You send your message and you walk away from it.
And
I think that's very dangerous. Now, Brenda, before we run out of time, tell us how can people get the book? The book is called The Birth to Five Book. It's by Brenda Nixon. And what is the best way for people that want to get that themselves?
It is available through all bookstores and online, through Amazon, Target.com, or they can even order an autographed copy from me if they go to my website, BrendaNixon.com.
That's great. And if they have any other questions to reach you, is there any other way to get a hold of you, either a blog or email?
They can actually email me off the website.
Okay, that's perfect. We've got just a little bit more time. Brenda, is there anything else that you would like to add in regards to...
Sherry or me?
No, Brenda, I'm sorry. Yeah, we broke up for a moment there.
Yeah. You're asking me if there's anything more I want to add?
Yeah, is there anything that we didn't touch on?
Well, I think we've touched on a good variety of topics. There was one thought that I just wanted to interject about teaching thankfulness to children. You know, what are mm-hmm. some ways we can help them with that? And also, I was thinking, pull back on the amount of advertising your kids see, because marketers today are so savvy, and they know the way to the parents' pocketbook through the child. And so if you can turn off the TV or not get certain magazines in your home, and your child doesn't get just completely ambushed with advertising, then they don't want so much. And that is a way to cut down on the gimmies and help a child be more thankful for what they do have.
Yeah, and actually to add what we did in regards to that, we did a couple of things. One is that we rented more or purchased more videos so that they would watch videos rather than watch commercial television. Also, and I feel like I'm doing a this isn't supposed to be a commercial for them, but there was a cartoon network called Boomerang that didn't have commercials. It was a commercial-free, I can't even tell you where it is now because we don't watch it anymore, but when they were younger, it was, if we're going to watch cartoons or we're going to watch something, at least Boomerang didn't have commercials on it. So, yeah, anything like that that can be to remove commercialism. And one more thing that we did, which was, if you wanted something, if they said that they wanted to add something to a birthday list or a Christmas list, they had to tell us where they learned about it, and it had to come from somewhere other than a commercial.
Oh, I like that. You know, what's great about that, too, is you can also pick and choose, obviously, where you're going to show your kids. Not only that, but you can use these things as teachable moments.
Yep.
You know, if you pick something on some story that will help a child understand, you know, drug abuse or whatever it is you're trying to teach them. It's such a great, great way to teach them.
Right.
While watching the show.
Yeah. And another good series was called, what was it called now? See, my kids are getting older. Something from the Book of Virtue, from the Book of Virtues. What was that one? It was a whole series.
I know that book.
I think it was Answers from the Book of Virtues.
That's a great book.
But they put it in a cartoon series. So it was a series of things, but it took great virtues from the past, put it into a cartoon so that for the kids to see that, because at that young age, I mean, they want to watch cartoons, but yet they got to see something that always had a good message.
All about values, teaching family values.
Values, yeah, I think it was. Yeah,
I like that.
Yeah, Values from the Book of Virtues. I think that's what it was called.
Yeah, I remember that book.
So, anyway, Brenda, thank you so much. We really appreciate you coming on. And again, for anybody, the book is called The Birth to Five Book. If you didn't get her website, you can go to ours at answers4thefamily.com. And we will get whatever information you need to you on how to reach that. So again, Brenda, thank you, and we will look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you, Brenda. It was nice talking to you.
Thank you, Sherry.
Okay. And now I'm having a little trouble here. There we go. And so that. There we go. Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry.
Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis.
Yeah,
call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back. I want to share a little bit. Anyway, I want to share a little bit about an offer that was given to our show and to our listeners. Raul Perez, who was on the show from ABET Security Services, is offering the Answers for the Family listeners for the first five callers that call in. That email in or that call him. So we want you to email to contact us, that's contactus at transportingteens.com. He is offering a free narcotic search of a home in the LA or Southern California basin for parents that may suspect that their child is either using or bringing drugs into the home. You can call Raul at 626-255-2675 and again mention this show, or you can visit their website and request brochures for more information at www.AEdwardTTomSSallyEdwardCCharles.com or go to our website at answersforthefamily.com. Sherry, thank you so much for being here. And I want, for anybody that wants to reach, that if you want to reach Sherry, you can go to www.sgaba, that's G-A-B-A, therapy.com. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I look forward to more invites.
Yeah. Do you have any closing comments on the subject?
I just think this is a really important issue, and our work, again, with troubled teens or addiction kids that are dealing with addictions or separation, divorce, I mean, those first 5 years are just very, very important. I think this is an excellent subject.
Well, thanks for being here. I hope you'll be back, and to everybody out there, be good human beings. We're out of here.
Listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Only on LA Talk Radio.